Welcome to the Magic Missile Podcast. So the way I thought this would work is we kind of talk about the first couple episodes, the first, let's say, five episodes. I want to give like a quick recap of like the first episode and what happened in it, and then talk about what we remember from that day and like what our characters were thinking. So our adventure began with Jean, Voir, Lode, Rhyfear, and Balkis. The five of them woke up in the back of a trading cart that seemed to be heading west. They don't really remember too much about the night before, and they're heading towards Duskwall. The driver of the cart is a strange fellow named Balkin, and convinces the party that they signed up for helping them find a missing girl named Emily in Duskwall. The cart is ambushed by a band of goblins. The party members quickly dispatch the couple of goblins that attack and continue making their way to the town. The party did some research into who Emily was, talked to her parents, talked to the local butcher, talked to anybody that you could find that seemed to have anything to do with this girl, Emily, and found that she'd love to play near a local landmark known as Chestnut Oak Rock. You explored the rock and opened a magically sealed passage to find a set of pillars around a glowing cauldron. Chained up on these pillars were five figures. All of them seemed to resemble Emily, the missing girl, and you all picked one of the figures seemingly at random to release them from the chains, but then the figure quickly changed into a decrepit old man, unlocked the other chains and released everyone in the room, and then everybody but the real Emily teleported away. You return Emily to her parents and have a discussion, a deep philosophical discussion about what constitutes a sandcastle. You return Emily to her parents, Jean, convinced that the parents were in on it somehow, held the parents at knife point until they soiled themselves, clearly innocent from the start. And you guys started to head out of Duskwall, kind of embarrassed that you just held up an innocent family.
Was this the house that we destroyed?
Yeah, we kicked in the door too, man.
You did kick in the door.
That was like a dark start of our career.
That was really dark. I went way hard.
And then on your guys' way out of Duskwall, you ran into a old half-elven man who introduced himself as Basil Oud.
Boo.
Basil warned the party that the figures that were chained up were mages that were locked away many, many years ago. These mages had served the Dark Prince Diabolus, and Basil suggests traveling to Wildforge, as he had heard rumors that the Shrouded Alignment cult had been operating out of that city, and that the Shrouded Alignment had a singular objective to restore Diabolus to power. And the first session ended with you all setting off in Wildforge's direction. So I wanted to recap and then just kind of get everyone's memories or embarrassments or regrets or things they would do differently.
Maybe a few in the first episode more than elsewhere.
Did I do the forgetful name thing in the first episode?
I am sure you did.
Okay, because I don't regret that at all.
Because you had the sandcastle thing, and that was like, I mean, that was like perfect Lode right off the bat.
Yeah, dude, you had your character nailed from day one. Yeah.
Well, the name thing was just like, it's easy to, like, because you lose track of names. And, well, now I don't have to remember them that well because my character is an idiot. So.
It's very Steve and Lode at the same time.
So. A couple things. One, to give context around the sandcastle thing. Upon saving Emily, there was discussion that Emily loved to build sandcastles on the beach that she lived on. And
she was like 9, right?
Somewhere around that age. And she was a half elf, so even at like 9 or 10 or however old she was, that's even younger in half elven terms because they lived to be quite a bit longer, mature a little later, all that. So like for her, sandcastles were just a mound in the sand, like a perfectly round dome. And Lode was blown away, mind blown by this sandcastle. If I'm being honest, that was a flub on my part because I was so overwhelmed with DMing for the first time that I was like, yeah, sure. Round, I don't know, just a dome. And it became a thing, and Lode was like, oh yeah, that's a dome. So I'm very happy that you picked up that that could be a valid sandcastle shape, even if it
at least in Lode's mind. Like if we ever go to like a place with sand dunes.
Oh man.
We gotta find a desert just for Lode. Oh my god. I know it's the opposite of the environment we're in now, but oh my god. Oh my gosh. This is incredible.
Who built this?
If I could go back to one thing that I remember from the session, that I actually think this is probably the best we've ever done as a group, and we've only gotten progressively worse, is we had a puzzle in that first session. And I felt like we solved the puzzle not only cohesively, but pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And we've never done that again. Not in either campaign.
What about the time that you Rickrolled us?
That was also in the first session.
That was the first session? Yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah.
I came out pretty strong with the puzzles. So in the first tavern that you all went to, John was pulled aside by the local bard who was trying to win over the crowd. And I had prepared lyrics that took Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley and turned them into more of a
like a synonym for what it was.
It was a very poetic kind of fantasy take on Never Gonna Give You Up, and handed Mike the lyrics. I had them printed out. I handed it to him, and the rest of the group caught on so fast. It was so clear. And for a good couple minutes, it was watching Mike. No, yep. I don't understand this line. Like, what is going on here?
What is happening?
It took all I had just to like stay quiet on that too. Oh, it was like, gosh. Come on, buddy.
I remember Tom ended up being like the person of like, I gotta help. I think you ended up being like Mike, and then I was like, oh, and yeah.
I can say that like in character.
That wasn't an intentional puzzle. That was just supposed to be just something I was poking fun with.
Just kind of funny.
I didn't intend for it to be that challenging. But the puzzle in question was before entering Chestnut Oak Rock, there was a symbol on the rock of what looked to be purple acid, and it took a couple seconds.
Oh, yeah,
and mm-hmm. then the answer of poison was solved. Poison was applied to the rock. The rock moved out of the way. So, like. You guys did approach that puzzle really well. You talked about it pretty quickly and got through it and were able to solve it pretty fast. But yeah, since then, it's just been everything has been downhill puzzle wise because of how the trajectory has gone with puzzles. And I'm sure we'll talk about this more as we talk about more sessions. I've incorporated fewer and fewer of them.
We need more.
The practice makes perfect kind of thing probably applies. So yeah, I'll throw some more in there.
Yeah, as a person who was greatly struggling with puzzles in probably our next session that we're going to play on mine, I had to go to Tyler DM to DM and be like, help me. And he did. And I really appreciate that. but to get back to episode one here, I think I need to defend myself about the Emily family attack
stick up
situation.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about something else.
Okay, yeah, home break-in / assault.
Yeah. So a couple things in my defense. I definitely jumped to some conclusions, no but shit. But my defense is that it was
defense is I am guilty.
It was my first.
They didn't even have a weapon. You had the weapon.
It was my first D&D session, and I hadn't even really figured out what my character was gonna be, because like I didn't know, you know, now how Jean is, dude. Jean, that would be so weird if Jean did that now, right? Like I would never. But like then it was one of those things. I was still discovering who my character was, and I was like, dude, that was so dark. Why would I do that? It's like that's not me. That would be like something a rogue would do. And I kind of had to like when we got called out for it, it was like, yeah, that's not me. That's not how I want to play that character. That's not how I want this to go down that dark path. I'm like, that's not who I want Jean to be. But yeah, I was definitely jumping to conclusions. And then it was a mix of just really bad roles. And because of that, it just led me to continue to believe that I was on the right path and just not getting the roles necessary to learn the information I needed. And it just continued to get worse. Like it just didn't stop.
And the kicker to all this is, on the first version of Jean's character sheet, he was listed as lawful good.
Yeah.
I was about to ask that.
You called me up. Yeah.
I was like, weren't you lawful good?
War called me up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because War was like true neutral. And I was like, this is fucked up as a person who's not like evil, but not good either. But I don't bust into people's houses. I'm like, aren't you like a good person?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like I've done a lot better since. I have gone more. I think I'm a lawful neutral now. But and that was something I needed to learn too. I was like, that's really hard for me to play. And so it was one of those things. Let's make it easier on me. And so I did make a change after that first session. But I don't want to say I regret it, because it honestly helped me figure out who Jean was. I think that was a stepping stone for me. And I'm like, cool. And there's multiple, as we go through these recaps, we can definitely go over it. But there was multiple for me to figure out who I was going to be when I grew up.
So Tom and Matt, I was really curious going into the first session, if there's any inspiration behind your character names, or if they were just kind of out of a hat, they sounded cool. I mean, there's no wrong answer.
Well, yeah, mine's a legal term. Voir dire is the process of jury selection in Latin. It's just a name that you do.
You're a nerd.
I know. And well, I was like, it's just like, I was like, it's such a cool, it's like a really cool word for a very, I mean, it's like kind of an interesting process, I guess, but it's not something I engage in. Like, but it's just like, it's literally just jury selection. It's like, that's just called voir dire. And I, you know, I just, and, but it looks like dire, it's spelled the same. So it looks like it says dire at the end. It looks very intimidating. And sounds very, you know, fantasy, because it's Latin, and, you know, most Latin words look like fantasy words anyway, because of all the fantasy books that basically just took Latin words and made them into magic words, like Harry Potter.
Interesting.
So, Matt, how about you? For
football, nope, it was a random name generator.
No shame, dude. I can answer for Josh, actually. To a point, like I don't know what his full answer would be, but I remember when he was talking about like making his character and things like that, he wanted to have like almost like a surname for his character, but it was really like a clan name. So whatever it was, and I couldn't tell you anybody else in his clan's name, but I think it was just like he was part of the Fear clan. So his name's Ryfear, part of the Fear clan. And so that's kind of what he wanted to incorporate into his name. So that's a bit of what he was doing. He was trying to go for that clan setup there.
All right, so Josh and Tommy had some pretty good inspiration behind their names. You've got John Wayne Gacy.
Hell yeah, dude. Named myself after a serial killer.
And then you
That's
would
where
not...
we held them at. The bigger point.
And then my favorite thing about Mike's name is that we got to meet Emily Axford.
I love her.
In Seattle, who, in my opinion, is like the greatest Dungeons and Dragons player I'm aware of. She's fantastic, just like skill wise. And Mike would not tell her the full name of his character.
My name is Sean.
What about Lode? Did he come from anything?
No. It's a fucking Jake and Amir video.
That's yep. Fair.
Like the dumbest one.
Does Lode have a last name?
Vilkshelm.
Vilkshelm?
We'd never refer to it.
He literally can't say it.
I can remember it.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. It sounded like vaguely Scandinavian or something. I was like, that sounds like it might be a name for this ice dude.
Right, because you had like giant connections and everything too, which are like really Scandinavian Nordic mythology related. Mm-hmm. I think it makes sense. Yeah.
It just sounded kind of cool.
And it sounds cool. I mean, at the end of the day, it's why everyone picks any of the names, right?
John Wayne Gacy, dude. What cooler name could there be?
Papa John.
I do have a question for the DM. So I had forgotten that it was Basil Oud that had talked to us to send us on our basically our mission, like where we actually wound up going. Why would he send us?
The entire campaign started as a one shot. The first session, still to this day, is the longest that we've ever played one thing. It was over 6 hours of playtime.
Holy crap. That was all day. Yep.
I remember that, yeah.
That was a good one.
Three hours of that was just counting dice and trying to figure out what the heck we were doing. But yeah,
very much
good time. So,
and so like I had prepared this one shot that really should have been maybe 2-3 sessions, especially as long as we play now. But I didn't really know what I was doing. I just wanted to leave an open plot hook at the end of it so I could bring things forward. And I knew that the five mages would be enemies that would come up later on. So I wanted to place Basil as one of the as the fifth mage, the one that wasn't chained up in the on the pillars, because there were four and Emily that were chained up in Chestnut Oak Rock, and Basil was the fifth that should have been chained up but was free. The thinking behind that was that and this was like I had notes on like how all of this worked, and it the five mages had been kind of the right hand leaders of Diabolus during his last rides. This is all things that I should have given in a session primer, a lore primer. But that was 3 years ago. I didn't know what I was doing, and that was the first time I ever DM'd. I have a still very little idea of what I'm doing, but it's been 3 years, so that's where we're at.
Yeah.
So the lore that I spun out of this one shot was that Diabolus, this demon, half demon, demi lich, dark prince, had successfully taken over Ursulonia several hundred years ago. That he had accomplished his goal of taking over the region of Ursulonia, and was stopped by a band of adventurers with the help of the inherent ley line magic from the ancient Leviathans. But the idea is that the five mages were rounded up after the adventurers had defeated Diabolus and sealed him away into a demiplane. And they had locked them up in a way that they theoretically couldn't escape by chaining them up with magic preventing manacles that basically anti-magic manacles. But the premise of the one shot was that these anti-magic manacles had started to fail, and that one of them had completely lost all of their magical qualities. And so one of the mages, Basil Oud, was able to escape from Chestnut Oak Rock, but he didn't have the magic to break out everyone else. And so he went off and essentially used the kidnapping of Emily as a way to get somebody to unlock the rest of the mages. Because he didn't have the ability to do it, somebody else should come along and find, under the pretense of finding this lost girl, they should unlock all the rest of these chains to let the other mages out. They'll go restore Diabolus. And the decision to have Basil talk to you all was a bit of, now through looking back at it, I can officially say it was poor planning, but in the moment I tried to play it off, or at least my thought at the time was one of hubris, that he now that he knew that the five mages were freed, he felt that he was going to soon be untouchable and wanted the chase to kind of start you down the trail to, like, hey, you let us out, so it's only fair that I do something in return for you. Here's where our low-ranking members are going to be off in this other town. So in the moment, it was under the perception of hubris. Looking back, it was a bad plot hole that I didn't fill right.
I also think it's worth noting that, and it probably happens in just about every D&D campaign, except for the ones that are just incredibly planned out, but retconning is just a part of the game, especially when you're first getting started out. So I don't think it's that crazy to do something like that.
Yeah, I honestly didn't even know it was your first time DMing.
Yeah, I mean, first time DMing, it was my first time not DMing. That was like my different experience in the first session was I'd always played, but I'd always DM'd up to that point. But I never found a group of people where one person would DM other than me. So I was a forever DM up to that point, and then obviously got invited into your campaign, which I was really excited because it was like, great, because now I get to see it finally from the other, you know, side of the coin. So it was like, in the same way for you, I think, you know, a lot of new experience because first time DMing, right? For me, it was very similar. It was the first time, you know, I had the opportunity to not have to, you know, deal with all the other things that the DM has to deal with and really just have to, you know, kind of just show up, which is a nice little perk. So
yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts on the first episode?
Emily deserved everything she got. No, I'm totally
playing. Freedom from being chained up. Yeah.
Next episode, we're going to be chaining up John.
Major regrets, except major regrets for John, not major regrets for Mike, just because, again, I grew with it. So,
would you say it's major regrets for John or a story kind of like a pivot point for John?
No, like I think he learned from it. Regretful moment. I mean, Mike learned from it. Mike learned how to play John better, or the way that I wanted to play John. No, I wouldn't say it was a good point in John's life.
The second session, you all set off for Wildforge and went in search of the Shrouded Alignment. En route, you saw movement in some nearby brush and snuck up on it, only to find that it was a wild cow, thinking it was a dangerous monster.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had so much planning that went into this. Dude, so much.
Tyler, you were probably like, so frustrated with us.
Oh, no. I put that in just to frustrate you. That was
so funny. Do something.
So funny.
So funny. Did we kill that cow?
No, you guys
walked
away.
No. It's a cow.
Yeah.
And then once you guys reached Wildforge, you split up to investigate the cult activity. Lode and Balkus went to the local tavern and just started drinking. Vor went in search of an enchanter for magic supplies. And at that first enchanter, learned of a second enchanter that might have additional information about the mysterious activity. Jean and Rifier headed to the Temple of Cog, learned about Arathis, the goddess of civilization, and that these priests were all excited about something called the Festival of Creation the next day. They looked at the library in this temple and didn't find anything of note that would explain what the Shrouded Alignment was or anything like that. Lode and Balkus kind of asked around for a few minutes, but then just went back to drinking lots of ale. Everybody regrouped at the tavern, and a mysterious hooded figure introduced himself and said that his employer, Arcus Swill, wanted to meet the party the next night after the Festival of Creation. You guys competed in a couple carnival games, won a couple of trinkets and small prizes and things.
Did we cheat? I feel like War did magic.
We did. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I think War helped cheat. I don't think Vor won.
That's right. Vor helped load cheat.
Yeah, helped him get rings on something because the games were all rigged.
Yeah, the games were all rigged.
Yeah,
Vor helped load cheat.
And that's when he fell in love with you, man.
He's not in love with him.
I mean, kind of going back into the character development, like Var's relationship with Lode was very interesting because Var's mentor was a half-orc. And that was like a father figure and a big reason why who ended up dying and was a big reason why Var got kicked out of the school. So Var had had an affinity with half-orcs. And I think he saw a lot of his mentor in Lode, with the big exception that his mentor was a wizard who was brilliant.
I feel attacked.
But like that same character of spirit, you know, like the same sort of like good person kind of thing. I think he saw that. And I think that's why he was drawn to Lode, and also why he pushed Lode away. You know, kind of like, I think that was a big, at least for me, like behind the scenes, where my sort of like his relationship with Lode of trying to figure that out. Both like liking him and also like, you know, kind of having all this baggage.
I love it.
This session ended with the Periton fight. Periton had escaped from a cage as part of this festival.
Like a carnival.
And started attacking. And the party stepped in to slay the feral Periton. And at the end of that battle is when we ended this session. So this session was basically get to Wildforge, explore some of the shops and get some info, and then festival games and Periton fight. And that was the kind of overall structure of it.
Can I say, I think that one of my favorite things that we've continued to do throughout the campaign, but this is probably the first time that we actually got to do it, was really feel heroic. That is like got to be by far my favorite thing. I mean, we continued on to like save towns and entire like giant civilizations and so on and so forth. But light towns on fire. Hey, not everything was good, right? But it is one of those things that anytime that we felt like we did something heroic, like, oh my God, there was this creature attacking and then we subdued it or stopped it or did this, that, or the other. I mean, we've got a couple towns, I think, under our belt at this point. And I think that that's always one of my favorite things to like feel at the end of it when it's like, we've accomplished this really awesome feat by, you know, doing this. So I think this was kind of that first step with that.
Well, we did that, and then we were also, because I know we were worried at the time of what we just did in the last town catching up to us with the Valor Guard. So this kind of like helped us be like, oh, okay, maybe we take a deep breath and kind of relax a little bit because we kind of just saved the town.
Yeah,
they can't arrest us, right?
We're cool now, and then they spit on me.
But that one was fun with us of being like, are they gonna catch us? Because I know John, you were really worried about that one. You were like, we needs to go like now.
that was a big theme in those early episodes, is the Valor Guard being worried about being arrested for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Like I know, I mean, Var was freaking out about it.
Yeah, I was too.
Yeah.
It was a constant concern for Jean, especially in the early episodes. To the point where we literally have never gone back to our castle because I think we're all just too scared that we're going to get arrested. Now, I think we could take anybody who comes at us, like, military-wise.
I don't think Lode was ever worried about it.
Lode, you're fine, dude. You would have busted us all out.
So any thoughts about Session 2, our Periton fight? I think it was one of our first big fights as a...
It was a really cool fight. I feel like, yeah, it was like our first like little mini boss that we kind of had. And I also feel like, especially in the beginning, we were all still trying to like get our bearings as to what we were really doing in a fight. Like, you know, what is my character doing when I'm in this fight? And I feel like I, through the time that we played in these early sessions, probably had the biggest struggle because I knew that I wanted to play Jean as like a supporting character and kind of making sure I was keeping the party healthy, but I just wasn't sure what that meant as far as what I was doing in a fight. So there's a lot of times I'm like, I just use a cantrip because I wasn't sure what to do. But I do remember that Parryton fight being just really well like described, and you did a great job with it, and it just felt like our first like little mini boss. So
nice.
Well, it's funny because when we did that fight, I remember that I blew all of my spell slots. And I just remember thinking, I do not like spell casting range. This sucks. So it was quite funny to be like, great, so I only have a limited number of attacks. All right, right. Gotta use this a lot more sparingly. I can't just open salvo it and go, all right, got it all. It's up to you guys. Load, get them. Which I still don't know how you do that, Tom, of being like, oh yeah, I'm still playing a spellcaster. I'm like, good on you. Like, nope.
I still play a spellcaster.
Well, yeah, but he's like damage-wise. I look at you as more like a, like you were saying, a support character of like heals, buffs, stuff like that. Yeah. I don't look at you and be like, you're gonna be the main damage guy.
Yeah, it always becomes concerning, right? When you're down to just when you're getting down to just cantrips, right? Your DPS. And you're already like basically useless in any other function once your spells are gone, because you have, especially, I mean, druids are a little bit, I think they might be D8s, but you know, wizard with a +0 constitution is D6s all the way.
Yeah.
He has less health now than, you know, Var does at half of each of his levels. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, yeah, I think keeping track of those, but that's the nice thing about growing up levels. Is like, as you keep going up levels, like when you're at a low level, first level spells are like, one, you don't have that many spells to choose from.
Yeah.
And so you're like, if you want to have any non-combat spells, you're taking up space so that you might not be able to actually, or you're going to use the same spell over and over again in combat. Where you go up a couple levels, now you can like start to evolve it a little bit.
Get a little bit more flavor in there for you.
Yeah, exactly. Especially since a big thing for Var is, you know, he's an illusionist specialty. And I've tried to make that a major part of his character because I think it's I think it's a very different than traditional wizard because it's not a combat oriented specialty. It's a role playing, more of a role playing oriented specialty. Some of its abilities end up being helpful in combat at higher levels, but for the most part, a lot of the spells are like, you know, silent image and stuff that maybe work for a round in combat, but don't work very long.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that was kind of a struggle of like using his spells in non-combat situations, knowing that he's going to end up not being able to, you know, fight later on when really that's the only thing he can do, you know? So it's like, That's always a fun dynamic, but it's also why I like spellcasters in that way.
Yeah.
Plus, like, AoE attacks are just like, you know,
right,
AoP when you get to attack a bunch of enemies at the same time.
But I also think that, like, we definitely didn't plan this. I don't think anybody went in knowing what we were going to do, but I feel like we have a really good balance of, like, oh, we had, you know, these like two, like this monk and this barbarian, it's like really tough, these tough players. And then, you know, behind you kind of had like your couple of spellcasters. And then me as kind of like this like middling support character who at least at first didn't know what he was doing, but then figured it out over time. And for me, it was one of those things that I found out that it was more about controlling the battlefield, like that was the way to support. I mean, even in later sessions, I guess I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but in later sessions, it's still about, oh, we're trying to escape maybe this area. Okay, well, instead of using my skills to punch something in the head, I'm going to create a barrier of some sort and allow us to run away or, you know, do something else. And I've continued to just kind of play my character that way. And I think I've gotten better at it, but it's basically the way that, you know, my brain has now been programmed to work is the way Jean's brain is programmed to work in combat. So we'll see when we have Matt's campaign if I can actually get out of that that head cycle, but we'll see. It's been fun for me though.
Yeah, Mike, I feel like I should have played Sigund in our second campaign close to the way you play Jean. But I was still really much in that barbarian.
Yeah.
You didn't have a lot of opportunity. To be honest,
what did you do? Two sessions?
A next encounter.
Yeah.
I just got really entrenched in how load works and didn't branch off from it very well.
Yeah. And then,
Sigund.
And we'll see. I mean, but now you're playing a main spellcaster again. I mean, with
except I cannot roll above a 10 at any point, it seems.
You do have just the most awful rolls, dude.
The crack, not the Kraken, the whatever that sea creature, the Aboleth, the Aboleth encounter. I mean, you literally single-handedly won that encounter.
Yeah, dude.
So there was the one time I was good.
It was against a big boss, right?
I mean, it was a big deal.
Big game is the time to do it, right? Not against... Yeah. Well, it would have been nice to not have three characters die against those barbarians.
But that's for a different session.
That's when we go to the Curse of Strahd side of things.
Real quick, just talking about it, is Steve's asking me in that session, hey, Tom, what's your health at? And me being like, I'm okay. He's like, all right. And just blasting that thunder wave. He's being like, that's why you asked?
Yeah.
I thought you were like looking to heal somebody.
No.
But you didn't ask anybody else and you hit two other people on top of that. It's like, why'd you ask one person?
After the fact, I have these spells that would work really well up ahead of that too. Take us out of the situation.
So funny. That's killing
pretty funny.
That's pretty still, like, one of my favorite. Just like, Tom, how much health you got? Oh, I'm doing all right. All right. Boom!
So if you told me you were low, I would have done it. Probably.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. I love that.
So, session three of Ursulonia. To recap where we were at. You guys had just defeated the Periton, and we're standing over the body during this festival. And a Valor Guard lieutenant comes over and thanks you for your help, suggests that you go see the supervisor for more information, commendations, praise. Lode and John have a bit of a spat with these Valor Guard.
Literal spat.
And ruffle some feathers, and you guys go your separate ways.
It's a diplomatic way of putting it.
You guys head back to the tavern and rest for a bit before heading out to the barracks to meet the captain of the Valor Guard, Dwyn Fohand. And he gave you guys a warning about this criminal known as Arcus Swill, and also that there were some weird reports of cult activity near the lighthouse with the Bullywugs. Meanwhile, Rifier and Vor headed to an enchantment shop known as the Missy Curtain and met Amalvis Vidal. She's a mysterious shopkeeper with a suspicious trinket behind the counter. He seemed kind of welcoming, a little shady, and provided little to no information overall. And all of you headed back to the tavern, meet a human named Jandar, who led you to Arcus Swill. Arcus Swill ended up being a fairly kind, benevolent criminal mastermind with a seemingly extensive network of adventurers all over the place under his employ. You didn't really get a ton of information about Arcus Swill other than he's shady, and he has some sort of criminal network. You guys left Arcus's bar, and Balkus noticed some movement in the shadows a couple streets away. Saw two assassins stalking the party and saw a glint of something familiar, and Balkus leapt into motion, attacked one of them, and caused the other to flee. And on the dead assassin's body was a token that Balkus had become all too familiar with, a symbol of a dark cult known as the Misty Order. So there's a lot to unpack here. I think we could start with the infamous Valor Guard interaction with John and Lode. To dive into that a little bit more, there was a bit of an anti-authoritarianism attitude from John and Lode, and the authoritarian figures of the Valor Guard didn't take too kindly to that. And one of them spat on John after receiving a bit of back talk. Tensions were raised. Things were close to a fight. But you guys decided to walk away. What were your guys' thoughts during that point?
I think it's fair to say that Lode and Jean were not ready to walk away, even though they convinced us to walk away.
It's true. I still feel like we shouldn't have walked away.
Same way here. I would still fight those motherfuckers. I would also say as well that, like, yeah, we were being a little disrespectful, but they were being way disrespectful. But I got my boy Lode. He was there with me. And I honestly think that this was kind of like the moment that Lode and Jean, like, had their kind of relationship blossom. If, like, the previous episode was Voir and Lode, it was Jean and Lode on this one. And we've just been inseparably stupid from that point on.
That's a pretty good summation of a lot of this party, just inseparably stupid.
Yeah,
I still feel like if we get a chance to go back and just kick some Valgard ass, we take it.
You do realize
we did that.
you did beat up this exact guy.
I'm talking about the Valgard in entirety. Bring down the system, man.
What's Lode's hate, or is this Steve spilling into Lode?
This is definitely a Steve thing.
Yeah,
spilling in to Lode the character, and Lode has more confidence than I ever have.
Oh man, that was a very pivotal moment, though. A small moment, but a pivotal one. Pivotal one I think it was a very big bonding moment for some of the party.
I think this is the episode or the session we started to tease out bits of backstory, starting with Balkus, the trinket, the symbol of the Misty Order. It was the suspicious trinket that Amalvis Vidal had in the back of his shop. It was the same trinket that Balkus found on the assassins. Matt, do you want to talk a bit about where the Misty Order came from and kind of what was going on there?
Completely honest, I, as of 15 minutes ago, completely forgot about the Misty Order. I completely, like, when you said Balkus saw a emblem that he remembered, I was like, oh shit. Yeah, no, we definitely did. That one came up when I was working in the fab and talking to you, Tyler, just via text message going, okay, I need something else for Balkus. Like, I need a backstory for him, except he's a druid. Good job. And I was like, right, let's make up a backstory finally. So we made up with the Misty Order and pretty much like the common, like, one person hierarchy and just goes down, and they were out to rule the world. And I know, Tyler, you said, oh, what if we build a medallion? Like, what if they have like a symbol or something? I was like, that'd be cool. And just later that night, we went to D&D and bam, the medallion just showed up. And I was like, well, all right then. So it was a fun little time. It kind of took me off guard where I was like, oh, shoot. And then I remember Balkus kind of just jumped on it and went, okay, we're going to take this one down. So it was interesting.
Based off of your originally written backstory, the Misty Order had cursed Balkus. Balkus was cursed by the Misty Order. He had the mind of an 892-year-old elf and was in the body of a 282-year-old wood elf, and had been on the run from the Misty Order. And there was a sorceress known as Remcast, who had planned to open a demonic portal into our plane. I say all of this, and I am reading off of the backstory of Balkus, because the Misty Order, this is one of the only mentions that we have in the entire campaign. this river dried up pretty quick. And I wanted to take this and tie it into our overall campaign a bit more and have Matt's backstory for Balkas like tie into the narrative that I was trying to put together, the lore that I put together. So the Shrouded Alignment, I literally went to a thesaurus and just looked up synonyms for Misty Order, and Shrouded Alignment was the closest that I could come up with that made sense as its own name, because there really aren't any synonyms for Misty that aren't like fog or like other weather conditions. Shrouded kind of got us there. And then Alignment and Order are definitely synonyms. And so I just found synonyms for Misty Order, turned that into Shrouded Alignment, and had that be the name of the cult that was looking to resurrect Diabolus. Yeah. But in doing so, that essentially dried up all of that Misty Order backstory and made it to where that it just wasn't a factor as much anymore. Maybe I'll post some of these old character sheets that I have that are super detailed. Like I have like 8 pages of backstory for Vuar. It has chapters. I kid you not. It literally has chapters.
It was I ended up doing Vuar, and then ended up doing backstories on a lot of the characters that were in Vuar's backstory. To sort of explain where they came from as well. So it was like Vuar's backstory, and actually Vuar's backstory of all of them might be the shortest, because I got really invested in his parents, who are dead, but like how like that happened. And I mean, it all like adds up to what had happened for him and everything. But for the most part, it was just like a really long thing about Grimm, his mentor, and about, you know, how his folks met.
That's probably a good place to leave.
Put a pin in it.
You've revealed.
there's still more to be coming from that, which will be interesting.
Yeah, and I have not forgotten. I have plans.
It's not super. I mean, at this point, Bark's got bigger shit on his. He almost ended the world, so he's like kind of like let's focus on one thing at a time.
Yeah.
I mean, Bark's big motivation is to get stronger so he can do the stuff that he needs to do. This is doing that, and side of, you know, maybe also will remedy some past wrongs. So
the fourth session, you all were in the middle of the streets at night. Balkas had just killed this Misty Order assassin, and you all head back to the hotel, sneak back, and for some reason decide that this is a perfect time to decide what to name your group.
Of course.
And Balkas's very first suggestion was Homewreckers, estimated 835 feet.
So for those listening,
no matter what character I play, it can have a 20, a 25, a 30 intelligence. You're still gonna get Matt.
The Mattisms on when he plays his characters are just the greatest thing of all time. Estimated.
So clearly not the same as established, which is what that should mean. Instead, the party debated for a bit and went with the title Chainbreakers, named after the magical chains that they had broke in the chest in Oak Rock, freeing the mages and starting them down this journey. That night in the Helmshead Tavern, Vuar fell into a deep sleep and dreamt about his mentor, Grimm. He dreamt of the city of Ravenbell and a hidden study that Grimm had snuck off to when no one was looking. And then through the dream, which played out like a vision, he saw that Grimm was researching the Misty Order as well. The next morning, everybody set out to find Amalvis Vidal, because Amalvis had a Misty Order medallion, only to find him missing. His assistant, Marcus, informed the party that he spent a good amount of time out near the Bullywug Tower, which was out in the Rodist Vale Swamp. Party heads out into the Rotisvale Swamp and heads off to find Amalvis Vidal and comes in contact with some lightly armored bullywugs. In the distance, they see the Mendelhorn Lighthouse and meet a lighthouse hermit that mentioned that the bullywugs had seemed more militaristic as of late, and all of their eyes had been glossed over for some time. And through these characteristics, the party came to the conclusion that the bullywugs were being charmed. The party approached the bullywug tower and fought off a patrol of these bullywug soldiers. The captain of the bullywugs approached the party on his own and surrendered. The charm spell had appeared to falter on him temporarily, and it gave him enough clarity of mind to realize that he was alone against five very armed individuals that had taken out most of his unit, and he gave up and you guys entered the tower. There was a short puzzle in this tower where if you pulled certain levers in a certain way, you could get through. Otherwise, you would just keep going through the same room over and over again, and you came upon a small study. In this study, a glowing white orb sat on a tripod, and John, quick to act, was very convinced that this orb was the source of the bullywug charm and pushed it off the tripod immediately and shattered it into 1,000 pieces. Bright light filled the room, and just a tiny puff of smoke emanated from the remaining glass shards. And because he was sealed inside this tower, he had no idea if he had just killed off all of the bullywugs or if he had freed them. And so John took a deep breath, and that's where we ended that session.
Didn't Vore say, don't touch it? Don't yes. touch it?
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure.
But if I could put a parallel here, while you guys were going through the Death House in Curse of Strahd, Del picks up an orb that he just assumes, like, does... I can't even remember what you thought it did. Like, I think it was like you guys entered this room and all these shades came out, and so you went over and you picked up this orb and you just smashed it on the ground, and it was like a magical item.
Well, so, it's not really. I mean, Del and Vlar are literal polar opposites as far as people, right? Like, Vlar is very risk averse. Del doesn't care. I think that's a good way to show the distinction between the two characters.
You play both of them well too.
I'm just defending myself in this moment. That's because I was rash in that moment where I was like, I'm just going to touch the thing that might be controlling people's minds.
No, I mean, that's a character trait, I feel like. And I feel like it's something that John and Vlar had a little battle. I mean,
it's continued on for sure.
As far as like, you know, risk averse versus, you know, taking maybe, you know, calculated or uncalculated risks, right? I think that's definitely, I think that's something that makes teams interesting, right? Because you'll have some people who are going to be like, I'm just here for the end goal. I don't think we need to do anything else. And other people are like, no, we're here. We should, you know, see what's going on. So
wild card, Charlie Kelly.
Yeah. It's good to have that, right? Wild card. Conflict in the team, which I think is important, right? Because it helps the team grow.
I guess I would say it's still a little strange that, like, we still refer to ourselves as the Chainbreakers, even though...
How bad of a thing that was.
And it, like, also is kind of just off of the timeline as it is anyway.
I stand by Wreckers, and you guys said no.
I think it's still... I like Chainbreakers just because I think it, like, is a mark of our team, like, why we're still together, right? Because, like,
I'm just saying it's a bad thing. I'm just thinking it's kind of amusing.
I thought it was a cool name when I was coming up with it.
In game time, it hasn't been that long.
Yeah, it's been about 2 months.
Right,
like... a month and a half.
Yeah, so, like, that... the fact that we've unleashed this horrific evil on the world... is probably pretty, like, fresh in our memories. As far I know, for Vlar, it's like, because Vlar doesn't work well, really, like, well with others, and the reason he's with the team still and doing, like, the things that the team is doing is because he feels responsible for, you know, setting this off and feels like he has to do something about it. I think without that, you know, Vlar would already probably just have gone back, but he feels he has an obligation. So for him, I think the Chainbreakers is like, that's... it's like I don't know, like a brand, like a, you know, a curse, but something that he's trying to remedy.
And that was really Jean's purpose for kind of bringing up that name. It was like, hey, let's remember the bad we did and turn it into a good. And I think we've continued to go down that path and continue to do the right thing. But that was kind of like almost like the religious part of Jean just saying like, hey, let's try to repent for what we've done kind of thought.
I know Lord brought up a lot of team names with the wrong number.
Yeah. I think one thing to point out is for me, and this is just me, this is like trying to remember 3 years ago and like what happened and like what we were doing and all of this, that, and the other. We've listed a handful of NPC names at this point, just random characters that you've made up, like his assistant Marcus, and there was the lighthouse guy. And it should be noted that I feel like the first time that we really hit like a connection with in this way, it was a bad connection, but a connection with an NPC was with Vidal. I feel like before that, I really don't remember anybody. I remember we like were like trying to find a little girl and things like that, but I didn't remember her name was Emily until you brought it up today and some of that. But I feel like Vidal was like the first thing that I kind of like remember as like, oh yeah, there was that character, and that character stood out to me. So that was one that you created really, really well. He enchanted and, you know, controlled the bullywogs and did all that, but it was one of those things that you played him well enough that I still remember him 3 years later. So props to Tyler there.
Thank you. This was actually one of the things that I mentioned, wanted to talk about. I've realized, especially early on in these sessions, I created way too many NPCs. I had like lists of like, all right, this shop has these three people working there, and this person, this like patron, like wandering around, and this person's name is this, and I had a first and last name for them, and like a vocation, and I had landmarks and buildings and like all of these different names. And it's no wonder you don't remember a lot of it, because I don't remember a lot of it, and I created it. Like, I created a very thin world. I didn't go deep into a lot of things at this point. I feel like since then, I think this is around the time that I started to thin down and kind of get like, oh, I don't need to create the whole world and have just a paper thin description of everybody. It's better to have like two or three NPCs and go really deep on their personalities and have a more clear person that these people are interacting with, rather than make the world feel lived in by having 3,000 NPCs that all just have a name.
Can't imagine how annoying it would be to do that and probably spend quite a few hours, and then us to just run through the town and not even ask a single question. I can't even imagine like just how frustrating that should be.
It initially was a little frustrating, but then I realized, because you didn't interact with a general store owner in Wildforge, that general store owner then became the general store owner in Veritas. Like, you guys had no idea. Like, there's no way you would have known. So I was able to repurpose a lot of the content that I made and didn't use, and I was able to kind of expand upon it and make it feel a little more substantial.
It's really weird. The last five general store owners are all brown hair, about 5'5".
It's a Nurse Joy situation.
They're all cousins. Mm-hmm. I think this is, so looking back and doing these recaps and working through some of these older episodes, I definitely have episodes where I feel like I had a good grasp of how to present it to you all, and a direction, and I was prepared with alternate routes that you guys could take. I actually felt like this entire arc, everything going from the Rhodes Vale swamp through everything leading up until the events of the next episode, I felt like I was pretty directionless. I felt a lot of it was made up on the fly, and that it wasn't as cohesive as I wanted it to be. But that's might be just being overly critical. But like this is an area, like if I was to go back and do it again, this is particularly the parts of the campaign that I would want to redo the most.
It's interesting you say that, because going through all these, like I said earlier, I did not know that you were brand new to DMing with session one being your first one. I thoroughly enjoyed it, even if it was made up on the spot for you. I had no gripes on it. So even though you'd want to go back and that's completely fine and redo it, as a player, it made sense. It was a lot of fun. It had combat, which I'm always a fan of. And yeah, so I would say that you're doing really well. And it is fun to go back and be like, oh, I should have done this here and should have done that there, because I do that as a player as well. But no, you're doing a great job so far. So I wouldn't beat yourself up too much on it.
Yeah, 100%.
You fucking suck, dude. No, Tyler, you've done a phenomenal job.
Speaking of sucking, let's talk about Mike's campaign.
No, guys. No. Tyler, I don't need to be roasted tonight, man. No, Tyler, you've done a really, really great job. And it was one of those things that watching you DM and kind of getting into it, I was like, well, shoot, now I kind of want to dip my toes in it. Mm-hmm. And it's chaos and nobody else should do it. Everybody give up now. But it's been really rewarding and really interesting just to kind of see the other side of the game, too. So, mm-hmm. And I don't do what Tyler does. Let me be clear. I pull from a book. I pull a lot from a book. So